As you know, in recent years here, I've been following the narrative lectionary, which is a little bit different than the other lectionary that I used to use. The other lectionary always kind of tried to put things together thematically in terms of a particular idea. The narrative lectionary, on the other hand, as narrative implies, seeks to tell stories. And so what we really have this week in the readings from Genesis is basically kind of an overview of the story of Jacob, the son of Isaac. And of course, we're not able to read the whole story, as it would involve about 20, 30 minutes of reading scripture here. So we've heard bits and pieces of what's taking place. What's interesting in what they chose to emphasize here is they emphasize the story of how Jacob gets Isaac's blessing at the time as Isaac was nearing his death. We know there's a problem in the family. Earlier on in one of the chapters, it talks about Isaac and it talks about his wife, and it talks about how Isaac loved Esau and his wife loved Jacob. So you have a kind of problem here in the family that's taking place. So Isaac is always trying to promote his son Esau, the older son. Rebekah is always trying to promote her son Jacob, the younger son. So now we get to this point where Isaac is old, says he's getting blind, can hardly see. He calls for his older son and says, "My son," his son comes, says, "Here I am. I'm now an old man. I don't know the day of my death, but it's coming soon. What I'd like you to do is go out and hunt and cook me a meal, bring it here. And after we've shared that meal together, I will then give you my blessing." Rebekah hears of this, and Rebekah brings and comes with an idea to Jacob, saying, "Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to cook a quick meal for him. Then we're going to dress you up in Esau's clothes, and we're going to put some fur on the back of your neck and on your arms so that if he reaches out to touch you, you're going to feel more like Esau. And then you're going to get the blessing from Isaac." The interesting thing about this is that clearly this is a plot. This is a plan. Okay, you know, it's not just that Jacob's going to go in and get the blessing. Jacob is going to disguise himself. He's going to pretend to be Esau. This is an act of theft. It's pure and simple. That's all that it is. Okay? Jacob is out to steal the blessing. And as we read in the text here, we know that he is successful in this. He misleads Isaac, and Isaac gives Jacob his blessing. Now, we know it doesn't go simply after this. Esau shows up with his food and goes into Isaac. And Isaac goes, "What's going on?" Isaac realizes he's been deceived by Jacob and by Rebekah. And he is distraught that he has given his blessing to Jacob. He does give a second blessing also to Esau, which is kind of an interesting one because Scripture doesn't play on it very much. But the blessing to Esau actually says at the very end of it, "And in the end, you will conquer Jacob," which is kind of an interesting sidelight that we won't follow today, but maybe someday down the road we will do so. Esau, understandably, is angry. Esau has been robbed of the blessing of his father. And as a result of this, Jacob knows it's probably best if I get out of town, if I leave. And so between he and his mother, and also at the idea of Isaac, it is decided that he will return to Haran, which is the area that Abraham had originally come from, and he would go back to Haran in Mesopotamia and seek a wife. And that's where the second part of the story we hear in Genesis 28 comes in. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran to go and find himself a wife. While he's there, he rests for the night, puts a stone under his head, and lays down to sleep. He has a dream in which he sees a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God are ascending and descending on it. I always have to visualize this as almost like a little escalator going up and down with the angels coming back and forth between them. The idea being that the angels are coming and to and fro between heaven to do the work of God. There above it stood the Lord. I am the Lord your God, the father of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I promised you. What Jacob essentially receives here from God is the blessing that Abraham had received earlier, the promise that his descendants would be the rulers of this land and would be the object by which God brings blessings to the entire world, which of course we know comes in the form of Jesus Christ and the salvation he brings. So we have two stories basically related to us here today. We have the story of how Jacob steals the blessing, and then the story of how God gives him his blessing. We should remember earlier, there's another story, of course, where Jacob cuts a deal with Esau for his inheritance. You may remember that Esau is out hunting, and he comes back, and he's hungry. Jacob has food, and Jacob says, well, I'll give you food if you give me your birthright. What's the text trying to do here? Well, what the text is really trying to do is explain something that shouldn't happen. In Jewish thought and in Jewish idea, family is everything. Genealogy is everything. The fact of the matter is things were supposed to go from the father to the son, to the next eldest son, to the next eldest son, and to the next eldest son. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. And so we have to have an explanation for why is what is considered normal not taking place here. Why is the inheritance of Isaac not going to his oldest son Esau, but rather to his younger son Jacob? It leaves us with a challenge, though. Particularly, Jacob does not come off as a particularly good man in any of these stories. He is the trickster. He is the one of a double mind. And his mother, Rebecca, is the same. It can clearly be made an argument that he cheated his way to the top. Now, we can understand that. People cheat their way to the top all the time. What's hard for us is how, after he's cheated his way to the top, does God now come along and say, good for you. You're my chosen one. That's the challenge. I love reading the commentaries this week. Almost every commentary starts off saying something like, what Jacob did is wrong, but here's why it might be okay. Almost every commentary spends most of its time trying to redeem the character of Jacob, trying to come up with a rationale as to why this is okay. Common ones are, well, Esau despised his inheritance, that he sold it off for pottage, so therefore he didn't deserve it, and anything Esau does after that is fair game. There is an idea that Isaac was making a mistake. Isaac should have blessed both of his children. And Isaac deciding to only bless Esau was an error. And so therefore this deception fixed the error that Isaac had done. And there are more and more and more of these rationalizations and explanations, all aimed with the idea of trying to take and turn Jacob into a good man. Because in our world, our way we think is that God should only bless the worthy. God should only bless the deserving. But where do we get that from? I don't think we get it from the text. Okay? I think we get it from our idea of what a fair universe is supposed to look like. What if we don't try and rationalize Jacob? What if we don't try and turn Jacob into the hero of the story? What are we left with? We're left with a God who makes his own decisions. We're left with a God who uses imperfect people to do his will and his purpose in the world. And this is, of course, not the only situation where he does this. This is at least intramural. It's within the family. You know, this is between Jacob and Esau. They're both descendants of Abraham. So therefore, to a certain extent, whoever wins is still winning the line of Abraham. And what God had promised to Abraham is going to come true. But when we get later, we find God favoring people like Darius, who is not an Israelite at all. And he gives him the power to conquer Israel. And he uses him for his purposes. I think of the passage they've linked with this, which is the passage from John about the calling of the disciples. Nathanael approaches Jesus, and Jesus goes, "Here's a true Israelite in which there is nothing false." Now, we like that, don't we? Here's Nathanael. He's a good Israelite. He does everything right, okay? And God, Christ calls him to be one of his disciples. And you go, that's just right. You know, the good guy is getting his reward. But think about who else he called. He called Matthew, the tax collector, to come and to follow him. He called Peter, the one who denies him after his death, to come and follow him. He calls Judas, the one who betrays him, to come and follow him. I've told you many times one of the passages of scripture that sticks with me way more ever since I first recognized it when I came here to preach on a Maundy Thursday, is to think that there on the night before he's betrayed by Judas, Christ gets down and washes Judas's feet. And this is after he already knows who's going to betray him. God calls and uses imperfect people. As a result of that, I don't necessarily feel compelled to try and rationalize the goodness of Jacob. Jacob is a human being with the flaws of human beings. He's concerned about wealth, he's concerned about power, he's concerned about authority, and like many human beings, he's willing to cut corners to get what he wants. But what's inescapable? What's inescapable is the will of God. Now again, I tread on dangerous grounds. Because the other thing you could say about all of this is, well, God always intended it to go this way. In a sense, Jacob is just doing God's plan, so therefore it is by definition right. Again, there's nothing in Scripture that says that. Okay? There's nothing in Scripture that says this was God's plan. Again, that becomes a kind of philosophical way we make the story fit with our view of the world and how the world is supposed to operate. Again, think hypothetically. What if this was not God's plan? But yet, what is God able to do? He's able to use it and modify it and change it to become part of God's plan. This is an important part, I think, of my theology. People always talk about, God's will's not going to happen. And I always want to look at them and go, yes, it is. You may not recognize how it's going to happen, but it's going to happen. You know, you can try and thwart it all you want. It ain't going to happen. Because God's going to make it work out right in the end. There's the famous passage of Scripture, and I'm going to blank on where it occurs, but there's a great one where the Apostle Paul says, God makes all things, good and bad, work together for those who love him. He makes everything work out in the end according to his purposes. So what do I draw from the story of Jacob? Well, I'm certainly not going to stand up here and hold up Jacob as an archetype and say, yep, this is what you should be like, a little bit cheating, a little bit deceitful, and that'll work well for you. I don't also want to get up here and say, well, God just can use anybody and everyone. He certainly can, and God can use any situation and work to redeem it. And that's undoubtedly true. But the thought I want to leave you with is this one. If God could use Jacob with all his imperfections to do his will, how much more can God use us if we are faithful, if we're doing the right thing, if we obey the will of God? How much more can we be used? And I see this all the way through the patriarchs. There's just time after time where the patriarchs take shortcuts to try and get where they want to go. And you just think about how much more would this have worked as a good process if God had not constantly having to be overcoming the failings of these human beings he's working with. But he does. And he will for us, because all of us are going to fail as well. All of us are going to fall short of being the people that God has exactly called us to be. But yet, God's purpose will not be thwarted. His plan will not be derailed. But yet, it is best for us to seek to be the people he's called us to be, to live the lives he's called us to live, and to allow ourselves to be used by him, not for our glory, but the glory of his kingdom, now and forever.